Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Mark Sawyer. Dr. Sawyer is professor of pediatrics and infectious disease at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. He's also a member of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices for the CDC. Why don't you stick around and join us as we discuss immunization risks, the history of vaccine refusal in the United States, and the effects of immunizations on health. To reach us in Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@kska.org. Dr. Sawyer also has some research interests, two of which involve immunizations. He's interested in immunization delivery, problems and issues related to that, as well as doing clinical trials on new vaccines. Dr. Sawyer, it's a pleasure to have you joining us on Line One.
Thanks very much, Thad. It's a pleasure to be up here in Anchorage.
So you're going to be here to do an immunization conference.
I am. There's a big conference going on the next 2 days here in Anchorage. I'm going to participate in that and hopefully learn some more things myself.
All right. So in healthcare, you can't talk about healthcare for very long without talking about immunizations a little bit. So we'll get into that in a big way. But I like to start with definitions. So what is an immunization? How the heck do those things work in the first place?
Well, the whole idea of an immunization is it basically trains your immune system to react to a germ, a bacteria, a virus, or whatever, so that when you come across it in your daily life, you don't get sick from it. So vaccines are either whole organisms, bacteria or viruses, or purified parts of a bacteria or a virus that are constituted such that when they're given to you, your immune system reacts to them just the same way it does to the natural infection. You develop antibodies and your lymphocyte system responds so that the next time you see that, you don't get sick from it.
And if we're going to give somebody a vaccine, I mean, one of the tenets of medicine is that the treatment should be safer than the natural illness that you're trying to treat. So how does that square with giving people immunizations?
It's a great question, and it's a question that is on parents' minds these days. Are vaccines really safe? Are they tested well enough? Do we know that they're worth it? And bottom line is that they are, but what I want people to understand is that the process for choosing a vaccine and recommending it at the ages at which it's recommended is an extremely thorough process involving hundreds of scientists, many, many studies. It starts with the FDA, which everyone knows about, which recommends a vaccine to be approved, but it doesn't stop there. Professional groups get together. One of them is this Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices that I'm currently on at CDC. We review all of the studies, including all of the safety studies. We look at the need for the vaccine. Do we have enough of the disease to make it worthwhile to immunize? We make sure that it's safe. We make sure that it's effective. And there are representatives from over 35 different medical organizations who come to that meeting and offer their opinion. So each of those groups looks at all of this data. And then it goes on after that. Professional societies like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Association of Family Physicians, they review the data and come up with their own recommendations. Bottom line is it comes down to a discussion between the patient and their healthcare provider who takes all of this information and makes a specific recommendation for a patient.
So what's the evidence of benefit versus risk if we look at the whole picture of immunizations over time?
Maybe the best way to answer that question, Thad, is to quote the Surgeon General at the end of the 20th century. His name was David Satcher. He said that immunizations was the most important public health intervention of the entire 20th century. And that's because the risk, the benefit, every time is way in favor of immunizations. They're effective, they are cost effective, and in this day and age of healthcare dollars, that's extremely important. Immunizations have saved more lives than any other thing that we've done in public health.
You know, I like to read the history of medicine and time. I guess it's something that happens as you get older. I don't know, but I get into this more and more. And I made a reference in when we were discussing this beforehand of an issue that happened about the time of Ben Franklin, when at that time smallpox was was killing lots of children in particular. And so if you read about that, the history of vaccine concerns and refusal and denial and really getting very vocal and cantankerous about these issues, it seems to really have been is a long-term kind of issue.
It is. It's gone on for at least as long ago as Ben Franklin's time. The whole idea of studying medical interventions in general and judging their safety. And the same issues are on the table today. Parents want to make sure they're doing the best thing for their children. And for me, the most important way to wade through all of that discussion is to make sure that you're getting accurate information. That was true in Ben Franklin's time, and it's true today.
I hope you don't mind. I'm going to read this quote that I had sent to you, because I think it frames the issue of risk and benefit very well. Ben Franklin at the time had been anti-vaccines and anti-using, I can't remember if it was cowpox. I think actually smallpox, or was it cowpox?
No, the original smallpox vaccine was cowpox. Yeah.
And so they were giving scratching people's arm and giving them cowpox, which prevented smallpox. And so there's a lot of debate about whether you're going to get people too sick from cowpox and so forth. But his son eventually died of smallpox. And so he wrote, in 1736, I lost one of my sons, a fine boy of 4 years of age, by the smallpox, taken in the common way. I long regretted bitterly and still regret that I had not given it to him by inoculation. This I mention for the sake of parents who omit that operation on the supposition that they should never forgive themselves if a child died under it. For my example showing that regret may be the same either way, and that therefore the safer should be chosen. So what he's saying in that English diction of the time is that there's risk of doing the vaccines, there's risk of not doing vaccines. You want to take the safer route, which is the basis of immunization practices still today.
Absolutely. I had not heard that quote before, but it really summarizes this entire issue for me. There is risk with some vaccines. With all vaccines, have some side effects. But what parents need to keep in mind as they're making a decision about choosing to immunize their child or choosing a particular vaccine is, what is the risk of the vaccine and what is the risk of the disease? And when parents are given the accurate information with regard to those two questions, they're going to pick the vaccine every time. These diseases are still out there, except smallpox. Measles is happening right now in Utah. Measles is happening right now in Minnesota. We had a case of measles in San Diego County 2 weeks ago. And if your child is unimmunized, you're taking a chance that they're going to come across one of these diseases that are still circulating in our communities and get sick and hopefully not have an outcome like Ben Franklin's son, but it's possible.
So let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Mark Sawyer. We're talking about immunizations, risks, reasons for immunization refusal. If you've got questions or comments, let me give you three ways to get a hold of us during the next hour. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, you have to spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@kska.org. What are some of the more common reasons that parents are hesitant to immunize today?
Yeah, you keep hearing the same issues raised over and over again, and the scientific community listens, they hear those concerns, and has researched each and every one of them. So still the major issue that's on most parents' mind is whether vaccines are related in some way to autism. That story has been out there for 15 years or so now and continues to reverberate around the community. Beyond that, though, you hear the more general concern about whether vaccines are really safe and whether they've been tested well enough and whether they've been tested well enough given in combinations, which is the way we give them now. You hear perhaps that immunizations overwhelm the immune system And I'd like to have a chance to talk about that one, because that's one I have a lot of personal experience with as an infectious disease doctor. I know what kids look like when their immune system is overwhelmed. They get bad infections. You also hear that vaccines are not needed, that the diseases aren't around or they're not really that bad, so we don't really need some of these newfangled vaccines that are coming out. And sometimes you even hear, Thad, that you and I are in a giant conspiracy with a pharmaceutical company to give children vaccines for our own profit. And that's one of the craziest ones that's out there.
Yeah, that bothers me a lot, too. There's very few businesses out there going around giving people something that keeps other people from coming in to see them. And that's what we spend a lot of time and effort, including this time, trying to get people to get immunized so we won't have to see them.
And you hear from most pediatricians that they lose money or at least break even on vaccines. They certainly don't make money.
Yep. Well, let's talk about the autism issue then. Let's try to get that one over with once and for all.
We've been trying to get that one over with for many, many years. So this whole story about vaccines and autism really dated back to a research paper in 1998 by a British researcher, Andrew Wakefield, who did a small study, I think it was with 12 children, and he actually was trying to link MMR vaccine with gut disease. He's a gastroenterologist, but also made this the association that the children who had evidence of measles antigen in their tissues and that somehow had caused autism. And somehow that story really sparked with the community and people picked up on it and have been sort of regurgitating this idea that vaccines cause autism. As I mentioned before, the scientific community listens to those concerns and has now done on the order of 20 very large studies to look at this question, do vaccines cause autism? And what we can say now, today, in 2011, that we couldn't say in 1998, is that vaccines do not cause autism. It's been studied extremely thoroughly. Beyond that, the original study, it turns out, by Andrew Wakefield, was actually full of falsified data. He has very recently gone through a sanctioning process in the United Kingdom by the United Kingdom medical authorities who reviewed his research, the way it was conducted, the conclusions he reached, and have described it as, quote, an elaborate fraud. And yet that elaborate fraud has really carried many parents to what I think is an unfortunate and bad decision to not immunize their children because they believed what he said about it. Just to show how inaccurate his information was, there were, 10 or 12 authors on that paper. Most of them withdrew their names from publication once they realized that the data really wasn't accurate. And that data, that discovery or that finding that he claimed in that paper has never been reproduced. In fact, to the contrary, many, many studies have now looked at that question. And we can say today that vaccines don't cause autism.
That story is a bad reflection on the medical system of publications in general. That original study was published in The Lancet, a very prominent journal. So it shows that even fallacious information sometimes gets into the system. But it also reflects this difficulty that families have. I mean, it's almost like people at some point are just looking for reasons to blame problems on vaccines, frankly. Thimerosal is right next door to measles, mumps, or to, well, the MMR, but the mercury component that has been used in some vaccines is being blamed for autism as well.
Yeah, that came up next. Once Andrew Wakefield's research was shown not to be accurate and no one could reproduce it, people who had general concerns about vaccines shifted their target to thimerosal, which, as you said, is a preservative that had been in vaccines for decades and not known to cause any problem. But it was mercury-based, and there was therefore a theoretical concern that it could be a problem. Once again, the scientific community listened to those concerns and actually have now taken thimerosal out of vaccines. And, you know, once again, that what that has provided us now is the best evidence we're ever going to get about thimerosal and autism. That is, it's been taken out of vaccines so that if thimerosal was causing autism, autism should have gone away. And it's been out of the vaccines for about 5 or 6 years now, and autism rates are at least as high as they've always been. So we can say now, with 100% accuracy, that thimerosal does not cause autism either.
You mentioned also that another reason that families are concerned, and I've heard this myself, is that it's the number of immunizations we give today, which are without question more than we gave 20 years ago. So how can we rationalize that this does not have a significant effect on the immune system and, in a sense, overwhelms the immune system?
Yeah, I'll be happy to talk about that, but first I want to celebrate the fact that we have so many vaccines. So you and I were talking before the show that neither of us have seen a case of Haemophilus meningitis mm-hmm. in a number of years. When you and I were in training, mm-hmm. you know, we used to see one probably once a week. We knew how to do lumbar punctures at 3 a.m. with one eye closed because we did them every night we were on call. Mm-hmm. And the current house staff don't have that experience, thank goodness, because they don't see those diseases. So we can now prevent so many diseases that we couldn't just 20 years ago when I was in my training. So, but how does that work? Why, how can we afford to give so many different vaccines, more vaccines than we used to? Well, one way to answer that is actually the vaccines we're giving now are so much more pure than the vaccines in our day that we're giving less stimulus to the immune system overall. In the 1980s, we used a vaccine called DPT, prevents diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus. This was a whole bacteria a derived vaccine, and it was very impure, and it caused a lot of side effects. It had hundreds of different antigens in it. Back when we were giving smallpox vaccine, you mentioned smallpox and Ben Franklin, that was a whole virus vaccine that had hundreds of different antigens in it. Many vaccines now are purified so that there are only one or two antigens. So in fact, your immune system is getting stimulated with less now than it did then. I guess the other way to respond to that concern is to think about where your children, what your children are exposed to every day in the world. From the minute they come out of the mother's womb, babies are surrounded by bacteria and viruses and dirt and other things that are in our environment, and your immune system is developed to respond to those things. Those of you who let your children go out and play in mud puddles, which most of us do at one point in our life, if you ever did elementary biology and did a culture of the water in a mud puddle, you would be astounded at all the things in there. So your immune system is designed to respond to whatever it comes across. And so we know that it's okay to give these vaccines together.
I had heard it said another way that I've used, and I guess I'd like your comment. I can't remember where I read this, but I think it makes sense to me that, you know, we have more bacteria in our gastrointestinal tract than we have cells on our body, and that certainly is not overwhelming our immune system.
Absolutely. Your skin and your nose and your throat and your whole GI tract is just full of bacteria, and they occasionally give you trouble. They occasionally invade and cause infection. That's what I do in my other life as an infectious disease doctor. But by and large, your immune system controls them all the time. When you get a cut in your skin, inevitably, you are getting bacteria that get under your skin and get exposed potentially to your bloodstream and potentially to circulate and cause serious infection. But 99 times out of 100, your immune system takes care of it. You don't even know it. You're fine, and everyone goes on happily.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Let me just remind you, my guest today is Dr. Mark Sawyer. He's professor of pediatrics and infectious disease at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. He's also a member of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which sets many of the guidelines for immunizations in this country. If you've got questions or comments about immunizations, risks or benefits, or want to tell us a little bit about your own experiences, feel free to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us during the program at line1@ksk8.org. One of the other reasons you mentioned that parents are struggling with the idea of getting immunizations is that they're just not needed anymore. So maybe we should address that comment as well.
Yeah, what we've sort of had illustrated for us because of the hesitancy of some parents to immunize their children is what happens when we have segments of our population that aren't immunized. And what happens is we start to see outbreaks of diseases again, which tells us that the diseases are still here. So I mentioned earlier, measles is in various places around the United States right now, today, circulating, and so unimmunized kids are at risk for that. Mumps, we've seen two large outbreaks of mumps in the last 5 years in the United States. Pertussis, I'm from California, so we just got through a terrible year of pertussis with over 9,000 cases in California and 10 deaths in babies. So parents who think these diseases aren't out there just are not in a place where they're going to come across them. But I work in a children's hospital. I do infectious disease, and so I see the consequences of these diseases. I see them still happening, including meningitis, which we do see from things other than Haemophilus that we talked about earlier. The other thing people need to keep in mind is just what a global society we live in nowadays. I have a slide that I use in lectures in that a few years ago, Tiger Woods, who's not as good as he used to be, he played in a golf tournament in San Diego on Monday, and in Wednesday he was in Dubai playing golf. You know, that's on completely on the other side of the world. It just illustrates how mobile we can be. And we have people who can get off an airplane today in Anchorage, in San Diego, carrying the polio virus. Polio is still present in parts of the world. And so we're really never protected until these infections are completely eradicated, which we're not there yet, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, we've got a couple of callers. I want to try to take those calls, and then I'd like to keep going along this same line. But Diane, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, I'd like for you to discuss, seems to be very prevalent these days, the use of prednisone. I'm finding more and more doctors are prescribing it, and I resist it for things that do not seem appropriate. And I do have a friend who has asthma and frequently takes prednisone, and I'm thinking that that wipes everything out, and that can't be good. What do you do to restore all the bacteria that you really need in your system after you've had prednisone, and why are doctors prescribing it so often?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, prednisone is used a lot for asthma that you mentioned specifically. We've learned that it's actually very good to use prednisone in short courses because we know that asthma is really an inflammatory condition, and prednisone is an anti-inflammatory drug. The problem with prednisone, and you're right about that, is that it's sort of a blunt instrument. It suppresses a wide array of your immune system responses. And we are developing newer drugs that can be more specific and just target certain areas. We use prednisone to suppress inflammation. It's the best tool we have when we don't know exactly what's causing the inflammation. That's why it's used so much. But you're right. Hopefully we'll get some more specific drugs in the future.
Let me expand on it. There's a difference between short-term use of prednisone for a couple of weeks or less and long-term use in its immune suppressant effects, is my understanding.
No, that's right. Short-term use does not seem to affect your immune system. But when you're on it for weeks and weeks, or even months, that's when people run into trouble with their immune system and it being suppressed. And it does do that. I see kids, right, and I'm sure adult infectious disease doctors see people who do get complications from long-term prednisone.
Yeah. So, Diane, the point is that there are times when prednisone is needed long-term with cancers and some of the autoimmune illnesses, and that does take a risk with it. The short-term use does not seem to have any particular use or increased risk of infections, is the point.
Is there anything people can do to restore the balance when they are on it often or for long-term?
Well, there's a growing field of use of probiotics to try and restore the normal bacterial flora that live in your intestinal tract, and some of those things do seem to help. So that would be one thing you could consider doing. Those probiotic products generally seem to be safe and are worth a try.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for your call. Let's take Renee. Renee, you're on line one.
Yes, sir. I was wondering, I had a course of shots for traveling to India, and I got, for about 2 months after I had the shots, something that probably felt a lot like rheumatoid arthritis. It was in my joints and in my soft tissues both. Mm-hmm. And I was very visibly puffy, red, and it like I said, it went on for 2 months of pretty extreme discomfort. especially for several weeks, it was quite extreme discomfort. And, you know, then it subsided, fortunately. And I've never had an attack like that before or after. And then I also wonder, I mean, you can comment on that. And then I also wonder, does it ever happen that a live virus is introduced via a vaccine, which then can go on to become a sickness?
Good questions.
Yeah, those are great questions. That particular reaction you describe is not one that I've heard after the travel vaccines, at least not the whole reaction. Now, if one of the vaccines you got was the measles, mumps, rubella, MMR vaccine, that vaccine has been associated with arthritis in rare circumstances. So it's possible that the joint symptoms you were having were from that, but I have not heard that it's associated with symptoms outside of the joint. So I can't put the whole package together. But I'm glad you asked the question, because the only way we learn about new or unusual side effects from vaccines, if people let us know about them, if they describe experiences like you had. And there is a system that's put together by the FDA called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS. And anybody can report to that system. You can go online. If you just search VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, you'll find an online reporting tool which allows you to describe the symptoms you're having after a vaccine. You report what vaccine you got. They'd like as much information as possible, so your doctor can also file a report like this, which can include the details of which exact lot of vaccine that you got. And these data are studied every single day by the FDA. And when, get a couple of reports that sound similar after a vaccine, they then investigate. That's how we learn about new side effects. So I would encourage you to report your experience to the VAERS system.
Sure. Okay, once I recovered from it, I kind of blew it off, and I should have gone back to the doctor who gave it to me, and I should still do that?
Yes, I think you can do it. You can do it now, even if it's after the fact, and I would encourage you to do that. There's no downside to reporting, and it's the way we learn about unusual things.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. Here's an email that I like, because I like the hygiene hypothesis, and so this is a, and it's amazing. I've heard more and more people asking me about this in the office, but so here's the email. You were talking about kids playing in the mud puddle. Do you gentlemen agree that it's beneficial to allow children to be exposed to allergens, bacteria, and so forth, so that they do develop a better immune system? Does that also apply to dog and cat allergies? Thanks.
That's a great question, and part of that's a little bit out of my field, but I am aware of some of the literature that supports this idea that if you lead too clean a life, it actually can cause problems later on, that your immune system does need some practice responding to things, and your body needs to get exposed to its natural environment for long-term health. So I have no concerns about letting my children or sometime soon grandchildren get into mud puddles. The next part of your question was cat and dogs. That I'm not so sure about, because we know that cat and dog exposure creates significant allergies in lots of people. So we're going to need an allergy doctor to answer that part of the question.
Well, I'm not an allergy doctor, but I'm a little familiar with this issue. I mean, the issue is, if you think about it, up until about 150, 200 years ago, we all lived around farms and animals and manure, and we got exposed. Our kids died, unfortunately, of smallpox and measles and polio, and now that's not the case. And so early exposure to these illnesses may have led to us to have some protection, which we no longer have. And as far as the allergy, there's clearly more food allergy. There's clearly more inhalant allergens in the world, in the Western civilization, and evidence that people who move from agrarian society into Western societies begin to develop more allergy. Again, it's very difficult to give very good proof, but there's a significant amount of evidence to suggest that that's reasonable. The answer is not to go back and let everybody get infected. The answer is to how to learn what the mechanism, if that is real, and then try to do something about that.
We're going to take a short break here. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@kska.org. And after the short break, we'll continue to take calls and emails and talk with Dr. Mark Sawyer about immunizations. On Line 1, your health connection, I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Mark Sawyer, Professor of Pediatrics and Infectious Disease at the University of California's San Diego School of Medicine. He's also a member of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices of the CDC. We're discussing immunization risks, the history of vaccines, vaccine refusal, and the effects of vaccines on health. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us at line1@kska.org. You can call us at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, and we won't be able to answer your questions at that time. Dr. Sawyer, here's an email. It says, what can adults who are vaccinated as children, who were vaccinated as children, do to protect themselves from children today that aren't vaccinated? Is there an adult vaccine protocol?
There are certainly some vaccines that adults need to get and keep up to date with. And in fact, I think the future of vaccines in this country in the next 10 years is going to be looking more and more at vaccines for adults. The one that immediately comes to mind is the pertussis vaccine, which is called Tdap, T-D-A-P. And that is an older child and adult version of a vaccine called DTAP that we give to infants. And that vaccine prevents against tetanus and diphtheria, but it also protects against pertussis or whooping cough. And the reason that jumped into my mind is, as I mentioned earlier, we've had a big whooping cough outbreak in California in this last year, and we are trying to get adults immunized. That vaccine is recommended for all adults up through age 64. And for adult, it's especially important for adults who are around new babies, because we can't protect new babies through vaccination. They're too young to get the vaccines. And it's babies in the first 1 or 2 months of life who get very sick and sometimes die with pertussis. So our strategy to protect them is to get everybody around them, everyone in their house, immunized. That includes their parents and their brothers and sisters and their grandparents and any caretakers in their house. They should all be getting the Tdap vaccine. Besides that vaccine, influenza vaccine, as of this year, is now recommended for all adults every year. So there are no longer special groups who are supposed to get flu vaccine. Everybody is supposed to get flu vaccine. If we learn nothing else from H1N1, we learn that the vaccine really saves lives, and it's important for people of all ages to get that vaccine. If you remember H1N1, which is just 2 years ago, we had young, healthy adults dying of influenza because that particular strain of influenza targeted them especially. And so now all ages are supposed to get flu vaccine. For seniors out there, there's a zoster vaccine that will keep you from getting the shingles. And just talk to your friends who've had the shingles. You don't want to get it. So you should be up to date with that vaccine. And I think the future is going to bring some additional vaccines for adults.
There is a kind of corollary question or comment that I think this gentleman might be asking also is, what about waning immunity? He said he was vaccinated as a child. He's now an adult. What do we know about the length of time the childhood vaccines are effective?
Yeah, that is a great part of the question, and it depends on which vaccine you're talking about. The data we have now is that the measles and mumps and rubella vaccine that most of us got as children lasts for a lifetime. Once you respond to it, your immune system has what we call memory, so that if you ever see measles again, even if it's 60 years later, you're protected. That's not true for some other vaccines. So diphtheria and tetanus, for example, the reason you're supposed to get a tetanus shot every 10 years is because the immunity wears off after 10 years. And so we need to keep boosting the immune system. That is probably true for whooping cough or pertussis as well. And although at the moment there's only recommendation for a single one of these Tdap vaccines I mentioned earlier, we are in the next year or two probably going to see a recommendation for every 10 years or some interval boosting with that vaccine. So it really depends on the vaccine. I think if you have a question about whether you need to get a booster of a vaccine, you should discuss it with your doctor.
Kristen, our engineer today, has put a link up on kska.org/line1 if you are interested in the vaccine reporting system. That's been linked on our website already, so you can go there and go to that. Let's go ahead and take another caller. Lisa, you're on line one.
Hi, am I on?
You betcha.
Oh, awesome. Cool. Okay, well, I wanted to just say that I think it's really super important. I've told this to every new mom that I know. My son is grown now. He's 24, and he got all of his vaccines. I never missed any, even though they were still starting to talk then about all the autism and everything. I didn't believe it, and he got all the vaccines. But we were very poor, and since we lived in Alaska, you know, we didn't have running water and everything else. And when he was really young, I wasn't able to bathe him more than a couple times a week. And he has never had any serious illness. And every time I talk to anybody, and I've heard this in other places, but it is my true fervent belief that the best thing you can do for your kids, especially when they're small, is after you've breastfed them so they get their natural immunities, let them be out in the dirt. As my dad always said, it's good, clean dirt. Let them be out there. Don't bathe them four times a day. Don't use hand sanitizer on everything. They have to get used to stuff. I think that's part of the reason why vaccines are not working on some people and some of our antibiotics are not working, because we've just so overkilled everything that our bodies never have the chance to get used to it. And I'm just keen to know what your guy there thinks, because I firmly tell everybody, let your kid get dirty. Let him be around the animals. Let him roll on the floor with the dog. You know, it's like yes, it will cause allergies, but if you do it when they're real young, their body will acclimate to it. They will get used to dogs and cats. And he's just been so healthy and so happy, you know, even though we had no water and he didn't get clean a lot. And, you know, so I'm just keen to know what what your guest thinks about that.
Good, good. I was just thinking, I was laughing when you said good, clean dirt. That's what we need.
That's the best kind. Well, we talked a little bit earlier about this whole idea about the balance between your immune system being exposed to the environment or overly protected from the environment. I want to reiterate what Thad said earlier. That doesn't mean I think we should expose our children intentionally to infections, because the price you pay for that is well beyond any benefit. But going out in the dirt is a whole nother story. And my daughter is a second-year medical student, and she's trying to decide what to go into. And I tell her, well, immunology is one of the things that we still don't completely understand, the balance between how your body responds to things and things like the dirt. So I think your son might be a good candidate for a study of an immunologist.
Well, thanks.
All right. Thanks for your call, Lisa.
Bye-bye.
Another aspect of immunizations that maybe would be helpful for people to listen to is the concept of a herd immunity. We've kind of beat around that a little bit in the discussion. What do we mean by herd immunity? Why is that important? Might use pertussis just as an example. You've kind of talked about that already, but
Yeah, I mean, herd immunity is really the concept I just outlined about protecting people around a baby. So the more general concept is that if you get a high enough proportion of your population protected against an infectious disease, then the infectious disease no longer circulates in the community. So measles, for example, has not circulated in the United States for several decades because we have had high rates. And it's only in populations where those rates drop down that an outbreak can happen. So I've mentioned earlier the current outbreaks that are happening, and in San Diego we had one in 2008. Those are happening in populations that don't have herd immunity, don't have a high level of protection. And the reason this is important for everybody, not just those who aren't immunized, is that once an outbreak gets going, then even people who are immunized can get wrapped up into it. Vaccines are not 100% effective. So you can do your best, you can go get immunized, but a very small percent of people are still not protected. So if they're in a community where we're having an outbreak of an infection, they may be susceptible. And the sort of the snowball gets rolling, and pretty soon you have a giant outbreak. So in Europe right now, you would think Europe is a very affluent society, very advanced medically, but they are having sustained outbreaks of measles in Europe because their herd immunity level has dropped down so low that their entire population is experiencing the measles. So that's what we're so worried about here in the United States. Not only does an outbreak get going, but people who can't be protected through immunization, like people whose immune system is suppressed from medications or from cancer or transplant patients, the only way we can protect them, just like we protect new babies from whooping cough, is to keep everybody else around them from being protected. And that even applies to influenza. So seniors, we worry a lot about influenza in seniors. They are severely affected by it. They don't respond as well to the normal vaccination. So even if they get immunized, they may not be perfectly protected. But if we can keep the influenza rates down in our community by getting everyone else protected and raising our herd immunity, then we're going to indirectly protect everybody else.
Another issue that seems to be pretty common and I hear parents asking about is this Bob Sears idea of an alternate vaccine schedule to spread things out a little bit. So what is Bob Sears suggesting, and what are the arguments against that?
Well, let me start off by saying I met Bob Sears. I actually was at a conference with him and had a debate about vaccines with Bob Sears. Bob Sears is a pediatrician, like you and I, who's written a book. And that's what his book is about, this alternative schedule. He has done no research on this schedule. In fact, he even says that in the book. So those of you who have his book, go in there and find the sentence that says, "My schedule is not based on any studies. I have no evidence whether it works or not." And his premise is that vaccines are not safe when given all together. Again, he has no evidence for that, but that's his hypothesis. So he recommends spacing out the vaccines. In some cases, dramatically. For example, his schedule recommends the measles vaccine at 3 years of age. If everyone in San Diego had not had a measles vaccine until 3 years of age, when we had our outbreak, we would have had a rip-roaring outbreak of disease. So people often ask, what's wrong with spreading out the vaccines? What's wrong with Dr. Sears' schedule? Well, what's wrong with it is that you are intentionally delaying the protection that you can offer your children through vaccination. You don't delay putting them into a car seat when you bring them home from the hospital. You don't delay putting those stupid plugs in the electric thing to keep them from sticking their fingers in there. But for some reason, parents are willing to delay protection from immunization. It makes no sense to me. There's absolutely no scientific basis to support a schedule. And the downside is you're leaving your child at risk while you're waiting.
So why the recommendation of so many vaccines so early in life, in the first year? You'd said we can't give vaccines really early to protect babies from pertussis and this gets into this whole issue of each of these illnesses we're trying to protect are not identical, and pertussis is a very unique outlier in this whole issue. But why give them so early in the first place? Why are the ones that are chosen picked at that particular time?
Right. That's a great question, and parents I know have that question. Gee, aren't we giving too many? I mean, it just seems like a lot for my brand new baby. And again, as an infectious disease doctor, I celebrate the fact that we give so many vaccines so early in life because we start to protect babies. But the key word there was start. For many vaccines, it takes 3 doses of the vaccine in order to build up enough immune response to be protected. And whooping cough is one of those infections. And so is Haemophilus that we talked about earlier that causes meningitis and bloodstream infections. So we need to start early in order to start the process of building the immune response. The second reason we start early, probably the more important reason that we start early, is that young babies are especially susceptible to infections. Their immune system is not really mature until at least 2 years of age, and certainly in the first few months of life, it's not mature. So we need to help babies get through that transition period by providing them the protection that vaccines provide so that they don't get the infections when they're most susceptible. Not only are they susceptible from an immunologic point of view, but if you think about it, their brains are rapidly growing and developing. A lot of the connections that go on in your nervous system happen over the first couple years of life. And if you get a severe infection while that's happening, sometimes those connections don't happen right, and kids have permanent neurologic problems because of severe infections. So for all of those reasons, we want to start as soon as we can and give all the vaccines on time so that we get kids protected.
Let me remind our listeners one more time. We're in our last 12 or 13 minutes or so. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and my guest is Dr. Mark Sawyer, Professor of Pediatrics and Infectious Disease at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. Our topic is immunizations. Our local phone number, 550-8433, 550-8433, and our email address is line1@ksk.org. Another thing that it seems to me that we have so many patients, including so many physicians now, that have not seen these illnesses. What are the risks of immunizations versus the risk of the natural illness? We've talked about before that it's important to weigh risk. There is no risk-free option here. So perhaps we ought to talk about the risk of immunizations in general. What are the risks? What do we know? But also let's talk about pertussis and measles and what the natural illnesses are like.
Right. There certainly are side effects from vaccines. I don't want people to think that there are no side effects from vaccines. And you said it well, there is no risk-free option. But fortunately, the side effects are extremely rare. And these days, vaccines are only licensed in the United States if they are extremely safe. One side effect that all vaccines have is that very few people are allergic to them. And so we've already talked on allergy. You can have a severe allergic response to a vaccine, so-called anaphylaxis. But I want people to know that happens like in 1 in a million or less. So that's extremely rare. Much more commonly, some people get fever from vaccines. They get local reactions in their arm where the vaccine is given, some swelling, some redness or tenderness. And rarely there are more severe reactions. I mentioned earlier the arthritis that's been associated with rubella vaccine. And everybody has heard about Guillain-Barré syndrome, which has been associated with some influenza vaccines, although not all influenza vaccines. But those side effects are extremely rare. And we think we started off the program with the Ben Franklin story that you have to weigh the overall risk and the benefit, and the safer option is the one that you want to choose on behalf of your children. And these days, the safer option is the vaccines because the diseases, as we've said before, are still around. So, you know, whooping cough in California, those mothers whose babies got whooping cough and died certainly didn't expect that to happen. And you just never know when an infectious disease is going to come your way. That's the wonder of infectious agents. They transmit between us anytime, any place, regardless of socioeconomic class. It doesn't matter whether you're in the mud puddle or you're driving a Mercedes, you can still get the measles.
I'm sorry.
Well, I just wanted to say once again, parents really need to understand that the diseases are still there. They are fooling themselves if they think they're all gone.
And they're much, much riskier than the vaccines. And we know that. We know what the death rates and the complications used to be, and we have lots of information about what happens when you get vaccines because we're keeping track of that.
Yeah, 3 kids out of 1,000 who get the measles die. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, we don't have 1,000 cases anymore, so we're mm-hmm. not seeing deaths. But if we did have 1,000, which we would have if we let our immunization rates go down, and is happening in Europe, kids are dying from the measles. And that's something that I just can't live with as a pediatrician when I know that we can prevent that.
Barbara, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Oh, thank you. I have a question that dovetails with the gal that called in about her 24-year-old son and playing in the dirt. I'm a teacher, and I'm a middle school teacher. I'm so glad I could get on right now. My students, they seem to be, and I'm saying this, quotes around it, addicted to the hand sanitizer. I personally don't use it. I just wash my hands after every single class. And I'm just wondering, and I've told them that, I've told them and also my son that it's, hand washing really well with soap and warm water and rinsing really well, sudsing up, is better than using the sanitizer all the time. I'm just curious about your comments about that.
Two comments. I don't want people to equate the mud with somebody with the measles. So when it comes to preventing transmission of infection between people, there is nothing better than hand washing or hand sanitizer. And they both work. And they both work very well. In hospital settings where this has actually been studied, the hand sanitizer seems to work a little better, maybe not because it really works better, but because people do it. So you said you wash your hands after every class. That's great.
Almost.
So
yep.
So that's how you keep protected. But it's hard to get people to do something like that and be very careful. After they contact somebody else, even just shaking their hands, that's an opportunity for them to spread an infection to you. And most of us don't go out and shake and wash our hands after we just met somebody in the hallway.
Sure,
and that's where hand sanitizer comes in. You can take a quick hit of hand sanitizer as you're walking down the hallway, and it does wonders to cut down the transmission of infection. Most people, most infections are actually transmitted that way, personal contact between people. Infections in general don't fly through the air. They don't fly across the room. You get them by contacting somebody and then scratching your eye, putting your finger in your mouth, whatever, and that's how you get the infection. So either way, if we can get kids to learn to either wash their hands or use hand sanitizer frequently, we're going to cut down on infections. And I'm happy for them to go out in the mud. They just can come in and wash their hands after that.
Right. Well, I also am aware that, on markers or the doorknobs from, to doors at school. I'm at middle school, so we're changing classes, every about 50 minutes or so. And if students want to use the restroom, then, I say wash your hands with soap and water, but they don't. They come back and they want to use this hand sanitizer that this other teacher has provided them. And sometimes they get up and, out of their seats and use it. So anyway, I was just curious about what you had to say. So
yeah, your call reminded me that, among the places that kids come across infection is school. We have seen a number of outbreaks of whooping cough and chickenpox, for that matter, and that's a disease that many of the listeners will recognize. But believe it or not, doctors in training right now, can in some cases not recognize the chickenpox because it's disappearing because of vaccination. So schools is a place where we need to keep herd immunity high in order to prevent these outbreaks because kids are so close together. They're together all day long, and it's a great opportunity to spread things if they're not washing their hands well.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for your call, Barbara.
Bye.
Dr. Sawyer, what's happening to immunization rates in the United States, let's say over the last 10 years or so?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. I think with young children, we've done a very good job of immunizing, and the vast majority, and in most cases, more than 90% of young children are getting immunized. But we can't seem to get ourselves up to the 100% level that we would really like. So immunization rates in young children are actually pretty flat, and in some communities actually dropping a little bit because of the things that we're talking about here today, concerns about vaccines and parents choosing not to immunize their children. In California, you can exert what's called a personal belief exemption for school entry, which means a parent just says it's against my belief to get my child immunized. And those rates are steadily going up. We're up in San Diego County at above 3% of kindergarten kids have exerted some form of personal belief. So unfortunately, the rates are not going up in kids. In adolescents and adults, rates are going up. They're going up every year for some of the vaccines we've talked about, the Tdap vaccine, which is for adolescents and adults. Influenza vaccine rates are going up in younger adult populations. For seniors, the immunization rates are also pretty flat, just like young babies. So we've been recommending flu vaccines for seniors for decades, and we're stuck at about 70% of seniors go out and get a flu shot every year. The other 30% choose not to. So we have lots of work to do, mostly in the adolescent and adult populations.
Got just a couple of minutes left, but maybe we should mention future vaccines. What's on the horizon that may be really beneficial?
Well, there's lots of potential new vaccines. I mean, again, I go back to the Surgeon General's statement that vaccination is the most important public health advance of the 20th century. That is leading scientists to develop more and more vaccines. So let me start off with a very common problem people have probably heard about, MRSA, M-R-S-A. That's a resistant form of staph infection. Staph bacteria are everywhere. They live on our skin all the time and cause serious infections. So there's promising development of staphylococcal vaccines coming, and also streptococcal vaccines. So good old strep throat may be a thing of the past in the next decade as we get a vaccine for that. On the world health scene, lots of development is going into the development of malaria and tuberculosis vaccines, which would save millions of lives across the world. There's even vaccines being developed for herpes simplex, cold sores, or genital herpes. So, you know, the sky is the limit, really. Any infectious agent that we know about, we potentially can develop a vaccine for. And the companies are working on that. The federal government is doing research on vaccines. So the future is bright for being able to prevent more and more infection and hopefully put me out of business as an infectious disease doctor.
What would you want to leave as the final comments today? What is the message we want to make sure gets heard as well as any?
Yeah, I understand that parents are concerned and in some cases confused about all the information that you can find, particularly on the internet. And what I want parents to do as they're making a decision about vaccinating their children is to make sure they get accurate information. For me, the best place for that is to talk to your physician. But wherever you can get accurate information, when parents are given the right information, they're going to make the right decision every time. They just need to make sure they get good information.
Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today, Dr. Sawyer.
It's been great, Thad. I've enjoyed talking about this very interesting topic.
We're going to return next week, and my guest will be Dr. Rich Savin-Williams. He's professor and chair of human development at Cornell University. Why don't you join us next Monday, May 16th at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection. We'll be discussing the trials and tribulations of being a teenager with sexual attraction to others of the same sex. Pat Yak is vice president of public media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Thanks for listening, and especially to those of you who called or emailed. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.